The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made our start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space show program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Great show for you. A quick announcement. We're doing the 60-minute format, but as always, we will continue forward based on your emails and phone calls and more information that our two guests have to share with us. But there is a hard break at the 90-minute point, so if you do want to call and talk to either Walt Anderson or Tom Olson, you got to do it while we're still on the air. That's an important requirement. Our phone number for today is 1-866-687-7223, and the email remains drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. We are a talk show. We prefer that you give us a call, but if that doesn't work out for some reason, an email is always there, and we look forward to hearing from you. Real quick, our newsletters are all up on the website. However, the newsletter information is going to update tomorrow, Saturday, for the coming week. So you can, I guess the best thing I can say is scroll down and you'll see the coming shows that are listed between now and the end of the year. A few dates left in October, and we're going into November and December for bookings. If you have guests that you would like to have us on the show, please email me those suggestions. And if you have electronic contact information for that guest, please share it with me and make sure you tell me why you think that guest should be on the Space Show. Don't forget we're a nonprofit, 501c3, and we're able to bring you great programs like the one that you're going to hear today, because many of you listening to the show today and others do support us financially with your contributions. There is a large PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. But if you're old school and you want to use paper and a check, please make it out to One Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to Box 95, Tiburon, T-I-B-U-R-O-N, California, 94920. Remember, we're a nonprofit, 501c3. If you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you're paying California taxes. You would get a tax deduction for your gift against your California taxes. So if you have any questions, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We have two guests with us today. First, Tom Olson is back with us. And those of you who listen to frequent Space Show programs know Tom. But he is active in the space community in many, many different ways for the past 3 decades, maybe more now. And you've heard him do the end-of-the-year financial assessment of what's happening in the space industry practically since we started this show. I think maybe his first show that he did that with was 2002, and he has been doing it every year and will be doing it again this year. His full bio is up on the website. To save time, I suggest you read it and become familiar if you don't remember listening to Tom before or have forgotten something about him. Walt Anderson is also back with us. His current bio is also up on the website. But we're going to be talking about Walt's company, which he founded in 2013, Avialto, A-V-E-A-L-T-O. And this was created to finance, construct, and operate a fleet of high-altitude platforms for telecom infrastructure services. Walt has been an active player for years in telecoms, and he has grown companies and started companies that have generated shareholder value of around 2 plus billion. That's, I wish I could do it like Carl Sagan, but that's B for billion dollars. And read his full bio on the website as well. So I'm very happy to have Walt back with us today. And Tom, good morning to both of you. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you.
That's Walt, everybody. And Tom?
No, I'm doing great, David. Thanks for having me.
And Tom is now in Florida. He saw the Inspiration 4 launch from his backyard, not because it launched from his backyard, but because he had a great view. Tom, you want to take a minute and describe the launch real quick?
That was kind of wild because I was actually watching it on my computer at first up in my home office here, and I realized people have told me, I just moved to this neighborhood about a year ago, and they told me that, you know, sometimes you can't see launches from the front yard. So as soon as that count hit zero and it started leaving the pad, I went running downstairs and running out into the front yard, and by God, there it was. And it was much, much bigger than I expected it to be, because I'm a good hour and a half drive, even from, like, you know, Titusville or Cocoa Beach. And so I thought it would be a lot smaller to see in the sky, some little dot of flame there going up. No, the thing was huge. It was huge to look at. Big, big, booming yellow flame coming out of it. And I saw the whole process and saw the staging and everything. It was pretty incredible.
Did you get any vibration from the launch sound, or did it not come toward your direction?
No vibration, no sound to speak of.
Okay.
That's one thing.
And nobody waving goodbye from the capsule. You didn't see that, right?
No, I couldn't see that. No, even when I tried to, you know, increase my phone range and, you know, go up a little closer, I saw nothing.
Okay. Good for you. Walt, we've got a lot of new listeners, and we have some new markets. So why don't you give us a quick 101 on Adi Alto and what you're doing, and we can go forward from there.
Okay. Well, Adi Alto was co-founded by myself and my partner, David Chambers, who lives in the UK. It's a UK company. And the purpose or the reason we co-founded it had to do with, we realized there was a very serious problem throughout the world, the digital divide. 3 to 4 billion people don't have consistent or regular access to the Internet. And the Internet is becoming part of the world community. So without it, you aren't part of that community. You're missing out on a lot of things. And also just the routine things that many people do with the Internet of communicating with family and friends, ordering things, tracking pricing. If you're a farmer, you'd like to know how much your crop is worth. Things like that aren't available to those people. So they're left out of a lot of economic opportunities that would otherwise be available. So we wanted to help solve that problem and create a profitable business to do it. So I've been working on this idea of high-altitude platform vehicles, the idea of putting a vehicle at around 20,000 meters, which is about 12 miles up. That's above air traffic. It's above the weather. It's in the stratosphere. And providing wireless infrastructure communication from that height, so we could see a circle of 150 miles in diameter, or cover a circle of 150 miles in diameter, 240 kilometers in diameter, from that height. And within that circle, we could provide very high-quality and low-cost telecom services. In most areas of the world where there's a digital divide, there are satellites in the air. There are satellites up there. So the question is, why don't those people just use satellite communication? Well, the reason is satellites are very expensive. In most developed areas, we're not using satellites to do internet. We're using fiber, microwave, coax cable connected to fiber. So we're not, we're getting the advantage of telecom efficiencies through those technologies. But if you're in a remote area, satellite may be your only option. And if you don't make a lot of money, it may not be an option at all. So we want to provide it a lower cost than the satellite, and a higher quality service, because we're closer to the ground and there's less latency, less delay. So that was our goal, and we started doing research in 2013. We've made a lot of progress. It took longer than I thought. I did not think 8 years from now we'd be in the final stage. I hoped within a couple of years, but it was harder than we thought, more challenging. But now we're just a short distance away from the goal, and I let Tom know Tom can talk a little bit about what we're doing right now to begin to talk to potential customers.
You want to take a quick email that already came in?
Cool. Okay.
Todd in San Diego, who always emails us, I've never heard his voice. I hope he's real. Todd in San Diego said, are you going head-to-head with Starlink, or do you have different markets and different goals?
Well, Starlink is I'm fascinated by Starlink, and I think it's wonderful that every place on the earth could potentially be covered. That's a wonderful thing, but that's not the market we're serving. Our customers can't afford $99 a month and a $500 terminal. So we're not really going head-to-head with them. What we're telling our customers, which are telecom operators, companies that already operate telecom services and want to expand to these remote areas, we're telling them that we're going to offer pricing to them that allows them to compete with Starlink, meaning they'll have equal or better quality and lower costs when they sell it to their customers. So we could say we're Starlink's competitor, but we don't see Starlink as our competitor at this point.
Okay. Tom, you want to go ahead as Walt suggested?
Yeah, okay. Where we are right now is we've gone through a multi-year development process from all the technologies, both the aerial platform and the electronics payload. We are now reached a stage where we have our final design in place for our full-size commercial version of the platform. And that platform is it's an airship. It's a cylindrical-shaped airship with a cone on each end of it and some tail feathers. And when we get done with it, it will be 101 meters in length and 17 meters in diameter. That's about, roughly the size, length of a football field. Correct me again, Walt, I always get this mixed up. Can we carry 100 kilogram payload or 50?
It's 110 pounds, 55 kilograms of telecom payload on board.
That's a telecom payload, but that does not include the solar cells and the batteries and the motors.
That's right. The powering system that powers the vehicle and the payload is separate from that 55 kilos. Batteries are the heaviest thing on board.
Yep.
Even though they got a lot more efficient, they're still a major payload weight.
How does it stay up there? What is its propulsion or
helium floats?
It's filled with helium.
Okay.
And that's our lifting gas. But we have propellers so we can control. Airships are controlled vehicles, not just balloons. They could be controlled and directed to where they are supposed to go. So it has four propellers, two on each side that push the vehicle forward or in any direction needed.
Listeners, I might add that Walt sent me a short video that I have uploaded to the blog that gives you an idea of what they're talking about, and you can and probably should see that video, which is posted to the blog for this show if you have not already done so.
Yeah, that video is a subscale vehicle. It's a much smaller vehicle than the full size. We were calibrating our autopilot so that we could teach the autopilot. Most autopilots require an airplane to move forward, and we're going to be staying in a stationary position for many months at a time. So we had to kind of teach the autopilot some new tricks so that it wouldn't think the plane was crashing to the ground when we're moving 0 miles per hour over the terrain below. And so we were calibrating the autopilot. It took weeks to do that. We were inside the largest hangar in the United Kingdom called the Brabazon Hangar. And that's showing our vehicle flying around inside that hangar, a subscale vehicle with the same avionics and autopilot that our larger vehicle will have.
So that I can be clear, which means listeners will be clear if I get it, you're going to take the Internet services and make them available to other telecom companies, and then people will subscribe or get their service from these telecom companies, not from you direct. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
It sounds efficient, the idea, like Starlink's idea, that they're going to sell everywhere in the world to every country in the world, every person. But I don't think they fully understand the scope of what that means. Even in the U.S., there are a number of languages and dialects which you need to be able to respond to customer service calls. And as you go out into the world, there are hundreds of languages and dialects which you'll need to be able to respond to customer service calls and written contracts and agreements and processes. And shipping the ground station to some parts of the world is almost virtually impossible. So we're relying on existing telecom operators. These might be people that are mobile phone operators that have mobile phone service in some countries, and they want to extend their mobile service into remote areas, and satellite is too expensive, so we can provide a way to extend their mobile towers to remote areas, or what are called wireless internet service providers. In many communities, small town, let's say in an island in Indonesia, there'll be a tower, and on that tower will be wireless internet like WiMAX, and other technologies that can link people miles away into the internet. These are pretty high-quality services, but the problem is if they link by satellite, their costs are high and only have a limited number of customers. So if we can replace the satellite service on those towers with the Avialto service, they'll be able to lower the cost to customers and still make a nice margin, and they'll get more customers in their communities, people who otherwise couldn't afford it. Before.
So you're not communicating with a satellite at all?
No. We use satellite communication when our vehicle is traveling to where it's going to stay in a stationary position while it is moving from where it's launched to where it goes to stay for 3 months. We use a satellite link to control the vehicle, to actually drive the vehicle there. Once it's on station, though, it's linked to ground hub, and the communication with the vehicle is now done over the lower cost links that we have in our own service.
And how do you?
Go ahead. Yeah, we do use space technology. We use GPS to maintain the location exactly where the vehicle needs to be, and we use satellite telecom to control and manage the vehicle until it gets to its destination site.
How do you launch it or get it up there? What's your process?
We push it out of the hangar and it floats up.
Very low.
We turn on the engines to make it go a little faster and push it forward. But if all we did was push it out of the hangar and release it, it's the helium gas that it contains. Just think of the Goodyear blimp on steroids. That's kind of our view.
How long does it take to get to 55 kilometers?
20 kilometers, 65,000 feet. It probably takes 2 to 3 hours, depending on local weather conditions, as we go through the regular atmosphere. If the weather is clear, we can move the vehicle forward and up very quickly. If it's not, we have to slow it down, just like airlines slow down when the air gets a little rough. 2 to 3 hours to get up to the ceiling height that it operates.
Sandra's listening out of Houston, and she says, why is it only on station for 90 days, and then do you move another unit in its place, or do you move locations?
No, absolutely. This vehicle stays exactly in the same position, and we hope to get from 3 months to 6 months. But during that time, when we change vehicles, we send another spare vehicle up. It takes over the radio signal transparently. Most customers wouldn't even notice the handover, and the first vehicle goes down to be serviced. The main service is helium. We have to top up the helium, fill it with more helium. Helium is a tiny molecule, and it gets out of everything. And the fabric, plastic fabric cells that are holding the helium on the vehicle, we try to make them as lightweight as possible. And because we did that, the helium does leak out after 3 months, hopefully 6 months. But if we made them heavier, the vehicle couldn't get off the ground and we wouldn't have a vehicle at all. So we had to find the balance between optimal weight and some helium leakage out of the vehicle. And we think 3 to 6 months is a reasonable time. After 6 months, we'll have to replace the batteries every 6 months because we're really giving the batteries a tough run. Every day they charge up from zero, and while they're charging, the solar panels are charging them, they're already operating the propellers and the radio system on board. And then at night, we're still operating the propellers and the radio system to maintain the vehicle. So by morning, the batteries are pretty much depleted down to almost zero, and the process starts again. If you do that with a lithium-ion battery every day for 6 months, even the battery in your phone, if you let it charge all the way down every night, every day, you will have to replace that battery, and that's what we'll have to do every 6 months.
What is your goal? How many helium-filled blimps, I'll say, do you need when you've built out the company?
Well, I'd say a minimum of 200. We kept talking about 200 in the early days. I'd say that's our minimum. But as time has gone on, we've identified more and more markets. For example, the sea lane. Right now, the maritime industry, they link their boats with satellite communication, which, again, is expensive. Now, this isn't even part of those 3-4 billion people that aren't connected. These are existing customers already spending money on satellite, and they already have equipment on board their boats. So we can put our vehicles in, you know, where it can see sea lane links and link to those vehicles and save them a bit of money. And, of course, why wouldn't somebody want to save money? So the maritime operators that service those boats, telecom operators that have contracts with them, we would simply offer lower cost service to them, and they pass it along to their customers. In a lot of areas, we'll be able to see both land and sea. And we probably won't tile the entire sea lanes of the world, but there's sort of an 80-20 rule in telecom. 80% of the revenue is in 20% of the territory. So if we tile the top 20% of the sea lanes, major corridors in places like the Panama Canal and the Malacca Straits in Asia, we will be able to capture 80% of the revenue and leave the other 20% for satellite, which is fine. Satellites will never stop being useful.
I have another sort of how does it work question from Josh in Tucson, Arizona. And Josh says, I have DirecTV, and I know others have other services that are affected by the weather, especially heavy storms or something of that nature. You said you're above the weather, but you still have to get your signal back down to Earth. So does weather, heavy storms, rain affect you the same way it does satellites?
Yes, it does. Slightly less, but I'll explain why. And by the way, DirecTV is one of the services we won't be competing with because geosynchronous satellites are ideal for one-to-many, point-to-multipoint. DirecTV services are something they are very good at, and we don't compete with that. We're competing point-to-point communication. But certain frequencies of satellite do get affected by particularly rain and heavy rains, and we're going to be using those same frequencies, the KU and the KA band. And so we will be somewhat affected. Because we're a little bit closer to the Earth, we're less affected. And also we have another advantage. The beams that are sending signal down from DirecTV are very large spot beams. They're called spot beams, but they're huge. And so if it's raining in one portion of that spot beam where your questioner lives, he could get knocked down or reduced quality during that heavy part of the rain. And there's no way that that satellite operator can solve the problem because they raise the power for the entire beam temporarily. They start interfering with other users in the world. So our spot beam being smaller, we can potentially raise the power within that beam if there's heavy rains within that zone, since we cover a smaller area. So we can have less outage than a satellite, but not completely eliminated. There will be some time, particularly in the very tropical areas like maybe Indonesia or the Caribbean, where the rainstorm is so heavy that for a few minutes while it passes over, you're going to be out. And there's no way to solve that. But if you're talking to somebody, if you're replacing satellite service at a lower cost and you're able to do it a little better and you're giving somebody a better deal, we don't expect a lot of issues with that if there's a few minutes outage every month. I live in Washington, D.C. area in a building that's wired with a major provider of Internet service, and I have more than half an hour outage every month. So. So I don't know why.
I know that there was a previous sort of similar effort with the Google Moon program that didn't work. So how do you differentiate from what you're doing there?
Okay, there's two major ones. Technically, Google, the main technical issues with Google is they had balloons, meaning no power. They couldn't keep the balloon in the same place, and so the balloon would float with the wind. Now, Google had a theory that if you changed altitude, the winds might be blowing in a different direction. And that is sometimes correct. There are sometimes winds blowing in slightly different directions, or even sometimes rarely the opposite direction at different altitudes. But it is not consistent, it's not controllable, and it's not predictable. And anybody who's ever done hot air ballooning understands that. Sometimes you can get up in the hot air balloon and change altitude and go all different places you want to go. Other days, you try the same thing, and the balloon just blows where it wants to go. And so it took Google Loon, the brilliant people there, more than 8 years to figure out that balloons are going to blow where the wind blows them. And for 8 years, they claimed they had a miraculous way to make that not be true. But that's just science. It's the wind. And they finally gave up and closed down their Loon division, and it no longer exists. It stopped operating. They had a second problem, though. They wanted to directly communicate with the user's phone from 20,000 meters on 65,000 feet. And they could do that. Their balloon could link to the phone. The problem is there had to be a balloon up there near where you were to link to your phone. So if the balloons had all blown away, there was no communication. The other problem was they were going to share the revenue with the local mobile operators. But the problem is there are usually many local operators in an area. So which mobile operator? And is their signal going to interfere with another mobile operator? They're burning up that signal to a whole 80-kilometer circle was their plan to cover 80-kilometer diameter circle. So in that whole 80-diameter circle, one Google Loon would be providing service as it moved away with the wind. And it just wasn't a logical business model. It made no sense from a business standpoint. For us, we can sell huge amounts of capacity to existing operators who already have customers. And we can do it efficiently without interfering with anybody. So Loon kind of never was going to be, and it took them 8 years to figure that out. I think because the management of Loon decided they wanted to keep their job instead of telling the truth. That's my belief and my opinion. And if I'm wrong, I'd love for somebody at Google management to tell me I'm wrong. Google Loon. I'm not saying Google was fine. Google funded Loon, and there were separate managers at Loon.
What actually is the bandwidth capacity of one of your airships?
We can provide 20 gigs of data to the ground. We have 12 to 16 spot beams on each vehicle, so a different amount of data in each spot beam, but a total of 20 gigabits of continuous capacity can be delivered to the ground through one of our vehicles. Now, if you compare that to early telecom satellites, that sounds huge. But now, for example, Viasat, Eutelsat, and others have satellites that have 150, 160 gigs of capacity. So for us to provide the same amount of capacity as one of those big satellites, we would have to have eight separate HAPS. But eight separate HAPS costs 15% of the cost of one $300 million satellite. In other words, I can put eight HAPS in the air for $48 million of capital cost, and they have to pay $300 million to get the same amount of capacity as that $48 million. So there's a clearly, that's why we're going to be lower in cost. Our capital cost is much, much cheaper than satellite.
Do you need FAA or the equivalent approval to put these in a certain location? Do they govern that?
Yes, each country. There's two regulatory issues in each country. The FAA or equivalent, and we're getting flight approval from the CAA, which is the Civil Aviation Authority in the UK. So we'll have, they'll have approved our vehicle for flight when we're finished with our development process we're going through right now. And that flight approval, we'll have to get that extended to other countries. Some will require us to go through a very complicated process. Other countries want this service so bad because it's a very valuable service to link their citizens, will potentially accept the UK's flight approval process and might not require us to go through the full certification process. The second thing is frequencies. We're going to be reusing some of the satellite frequencies on a non-interference basis, meaning you won't see it. A geosynchronous operator will not see us. We won't interfere. They won't even see us operating. And that's because we're pointing an entirely different direction. A geosynchronous satellite, they're spread out among 2-degree arc along the equator. Every 2 degrees, if you look straight up, there's a geosynchronous satellite. And so that means that the antennas and the whole system designed for geosynchronous satellite is designed for that 2-degree system. So a parabolic antenna, if you move it 2 degrees, you're going to be pointing at a different satellite or at nothing. So we're always going to stay more than 4 degrees away from anything in the geosynchronous arc to make sure that we just never are pointing at anything up there, and our customers' antennas will not be pointing at anything up there.
You have an email from Paul, who's in upstate New York. These platforms will be above the weather, but we'll have to transmit through it. You kind of already answered this, but I want to read his question. Do weather conditions affect performance? If so, how, and how do you mitigate that? So I know we've already talked about this, but...
Well, let me answer again. We mitigate it the same way a satellite operator does, by increasing the power appropriately without damaging anybody else or interfering. We are able to do that better because of smaller spot beams. We're a little closer to Earth, so we have less problem in general. We do have to be aware of the weather below us. So we don't feel it directly, but our customers will feel it if they're sitting in the middle of a rainstorm and we haven't increased the power to keep them online.
Jane is in Denver, and Jane says, so for each location where you have a blimp, I'm assuming you need some sort of ground station control unit. How does that figure into your capital cost?
Okay. Your listeners actually understand this. That's great. This is a gateway, usually called a gateway, and that is correct. Somewhere in that 150-mile service area, usually near the edge of that circle, we will put a gateway. That gateway has to be linked to some kind of strong network, either a fiber or a microwave network with significant capacity. And the additional cost is not, compared to the other capital costs, is not that great. We can put all the necessary, it's a very large satellite dish, power backup systems, and the transmission equipment and the housing for all that costs $300,000 or $400,000. So that's part of our capital cost, but it's not that bad because it's being amortized over many, many years of operation of the HAP.
Amazing. Listeners, you can call us 1-866-687-7223, or you can email us, drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. Where are you rolling it out? For example, I have some friends that are in Montana that have really crappy internet, and while they can get Starlink, as you said, it's super-duper expensive. I think the hardware is about $600, and then it's $100 or so for the basic service per month. If you want something a little bit different, it can even be more costly. So rural internet sucks in America, so are you going to be able to service that market?
Yes. United States will not be one of our first markets for a number of reasons. But one reason is that there are other alternative means to provide rural internet that are usable based on terrestrial services. Now, there are some areas in Montana and in Arizona and that the distances are just so great that using some kind of non-terrestrial service makes sense. But there are a lot of areas that just need a bit of entrepreneurship and connection by ground station that'll be ultimately economical for everybody once they're linked up. We focused on developing areas of the world where this is desperately needed, where whole large territories, even large towns, are disconnected. And one of the areas we looked at were the archipelagos in the Philippines and Indonesia. Those are areas where there is no terrestrial alternative. Indonesia has 14,000 populated islands where some people live. There's some large islands that have major cities like Jakarta. There's some smaller islands that don't have enough people to justify putting an undersea cable to link that island. And they're too far away for troposcatter connection. So we are the only technology that can solve that problem other than satellite, which is more expensive. So let's say the government of Indonesia may use satellite to connect their emergency services in certain government offices by satellite, but other people there don't have that option to connect that way. So that was one of the areas we looked at, and we went to Indonesia and began talking to potential customers, government, regulators, and we found they really were interested, very eager to have this technology at even the highest levels of the government, because the president there has mandated that all the unserved territories of Indonesia need to be served, and he's trying to find ways to encourage the operators to do it. But again, they still have to have a technology to do it and be able to find an economical way to do it. So the operators saw us as a way to meet those requirements to get it done. And, well, that may be one of our first areas. The other area is the Caribbean. There's a number of smaller islands there that are poorly served. And the other thing is, separate from those 3 billion people that are disconnected, when the cruise ships begin operating again after COVID goes away, there's just massive numbers of people sitting on cruise ships that want to communicate like they do at home, and that's not possible. Again, satellites being too expensive from those ships. So we have a massive market, a commercial market in the Caribbean for potential billionaire yachts and cruise ships and fishing boats and other things. So we think those are the two areas we may open first. That could change. If there's anybody on this call that wants to become our customer, we're happy to talk.
Tom, you're talking to customers. Is this an easy explanation and sell? Are you meeting resistance and challenges?
Well, honestly, it hasn't been that bad at all. I mean, they get it. You talk to people and they get it. They get how it could really enhance the service they want to offer to their customers, because we're basically a wholesaler and they're buying from us and redistributing to their customer base, and hope to expand their customer base a lot further than they've been able to in the past using our technology. So that hasn't been a super hard sell. We're just getting to the point where we're getting some LOIs from some areas. And they're basically saying that as soon as we can actually demonstrate our full-blown commercial version, 101 meters long, they're willing to sit down and write checks. So that's a happy day.
What is the timeline for that full-blown commercial demo?
We're hoping to complete it and fly it sometime in fourth quarter next year.
Okay. That's a year away, a little more than
yep.
a year away.
Yep. Yeah.
Any chance it'll get sped up somehow?
Well, we've gone through a lot of the – it took us 8 years to get here, and a lot of that just was solving technical barriers, like could we build a vehicle that could stay in a stationary position for 3 to 6 months? Could we have enough power to stay – even with the winds, for example, and the thing that even allowed us to build this was that batteries and solar panels have become much more efficient. The electric car guys have really pushed the boundaries on batteries and made some innovations that have allowed us to buy off-the-shelf very efficient batteries that let us build this vehicle. So we had to look at each power thrust, the launch and landing issues, designing the telecom payload to be as efficient as possible and lightweight as possible. And it took us longer than we thought, but we are now here. We know exactly what we want to build. We've tested smaller versions. Those tests gave us the information we needed to build a larger vehicle. So that's what we're going to be working on.
What is the material you make the helium balloon? What do you make it out of?
Okay. Well, that's a little proprietary. We have an inner cell that holds the helium, a number of inner cells inside the cylindrical vehicle. And then we have an outer material that's very strong and resistant to cutting and then every other abrasion and other things that holds everything inside that doesn't have helium in it. It's not holding the helium. It's just holding the bags that hold the helium. These materials are very innovative, sort of leading-edge plastic technology. It took us more than a year working with DuPont and another vendor to develop the inner cell material that would that was impermeable enough to helium to allow us to do it. That was a barrier, and we've solved that. We've got that now.
So when you start out, you're going to be starting out probably in those two areas. Is that correct?
Right now, unless something changes, we hope to be starting Indonesia. As I say, the very positive response, and we're already talking to the regulators there, getting also a relatively positive response from other regulators around the world. And so that would, and the market in Indonesia is just huge because of the nature of these 14,000 populated islands and the need. So that's certainly an area where we're very positive. Caribbean is not as certain. We have a couple people, customers who we're talking to, but not anyone as enthusiastic as the Indonesian customers. So that could change, and we have a potential for Western Africa. There's for example, Benin is a country right next to Nigeria that is using a lot of satellite technology, but it's a very poor country. And so we could save a tremendous amount of money and link a lot of people that are unlinked and still have a very profitable business there. So we're talking to people in that part of the world and other areas as well.
When you start out, I guess you need at least two airships to open up a market, correct?
Minimum, but our goal is to always have two in the air, one in the ground, minimum, just to be more efficient. And we hope to standard operating beginning will be three in the air, one on the ground, until we find out how resilient the vehicles are. So if it turns out that we can increase that ratio, put more vehicles in the air with one spare on the ground, we'll do that. But initially, minimum is three on the air, one on the ground, and then we'll go to four in the air, one on the ground, because we don't know how often the vehicle might have to be taken down for unplanned servicing. We know we'll have to service it every 3 months, 6 months, but what if something breaks, something critical that we really have to replace the vehicle? And we don't know yet. When you're building something new and you're putting it into a harsh environment, stratosphere, the temperature is minus 60 C, minus 70 F, I think. Anyway, it's very, very cold up there, and all the equipment has to operate in that environment. So we may be able to get a better ratio, but initially we have to have a spare available any moment in time, because if we go out of service, like when a satellite goes out of service, it's failed. You're stuck. You have to find another satellite to point your dish at and make arrangements to buy service from another satellite. We should be able to replace a total failure within 24 hours with a spare on the ground. So that's better than satellite, but not perfect.
Do you manufacture in the UK, or are you manufacturing elsewhere?
We're we're going to set up a factory in the UK. That's what we're in the process to do. We're actually raising some final funds right now, and those funds will be used to set up the factory, among other expenses. We've got a site, very good location, right outside of, about an hour out of London. It's in an old airfield, decommissioned airfield, called, that used to be called Rotten, not R-O-T-T-E-N, Rotten, but Rotten, W-R-O-U-G-H-T-O-N. And, it's perfect location. There's not too many guys using it, and, lots of space to grow. And, we're gonna put a large building that we have to build ourselves, because there's no building available large enough in the UK to hold something 100 meters long and 17 meters high.
You have a note from John. He just says, I live in the Bay Area, so I don't know where he is, and I don't have a last name for him. He says, are you able to utilize the latest in 3D printing, AI, and robotics for your manufacturing, or is this more or less old school still?
We expect to utilize those technologies a lot, since the first vehicles we build, even if we build the first 10 vehicles, we still consider those experimental vehicles, even if they're flying in the air. We're going to be constantly trying to update and improve the vehicle. We're basically building a truck, and 5 years from now, we hope to have a race car. So we're building something that will work and perform the functions and provide the services we need profitably. But we know that there'll be improvements, and using not only 3D plastic, but 3D metal printing and other technologies will allow us to rapidly change things that need to be changed and allow us to do rapid prototyping. And even the first vehicle will have a lot of those 3D printed materials on board. The main section of the vehicle is a carbon fiber keel that's on the bottom, and that will hold the batteries and the telecom payload and all the other things that need to be kept at a higher temperature. In fact, the batteries will be kept at room temperature. The electronics that we have on board, the avionics and the radio electronics, will actually be used to heat the chamber that the batteries and the electronics are in. The heat that we naturally produce from our radio will keep that chamber warm enough so the batteries won't fail, because lithium-ion batteries do not like very cold temperatures. So I've lost the thread of the question. I got distracted. I'm sorry.
Well, you answered it. So, but you have another one from Bill, who says he's in Maryland. And he says, over the years, there have been space shuttle programs about large communication airships by Lockheed and other companies. I don't know the names of them. I don't remember when I heard the shows, but they were several years ago. Do you actually have any competition in your actual niche in the market? Are any of the big companies like Lockheed doing it? I think their big airship may have burned down. I'm not sure if I've got the company right or if they rebuilt it.
All right. Yeah, and answer that. We're in a very weirdly unique position now. Lockheed did build an airship for the military. Cost $150 million. Cost us American taxpayers $150 million. And this was a number of years ago. So they built it in Ohio, and it was a pretty simple vehicle. It was all a big shiny balloon with some kind of propulsion system, propellers on it. They apparently launched it without testing or training the people running it. And 2 hours later, it ended up in the trees in Pennsylvania. It's possible online to find a really beautiful picture of this shiny big thing sitting in the trees in Pennsylvania. This is a common problem with the military. They get interested in this idea, and they fund something, and then they get bored with it after there's some failure, or they fund something so aggressive that instead of building smaller vehicles like we have and testing and thinking it through, they go really aggressive and spend $150 million on a single vehicle, which would build, we could build more than 20 vehicles with $150 million. There's been a history of that kind of weird, aggressive thinking of massive, huge vehicles, much larger than needed, with emission goals that are beyond any realistic goal. And then you push them out, there's some failure, and then you quit, and you stop doing it and then start something else. So that's throughout the world. And one of the things we looked at when we started the company is we went and studied every one of those failures, prior failures in high-altitude airship-type technologies. And we found some common things. One, over-aggressive goals, unrealistic mission planning, vehicles much larger than realistic, and we tried to avoid all those problems and build a more modest, realistic vehicle with realistic plans. In terms of competition, there's one other company that says they're building this, and this is another big contract. Lenia Thales is a European equivalent to Lockheed Martin, for example, and they are building a vehicle called Stratobus, they say, and they have some beautiful graphic pictures. In fact, they have four different pictures over the years. They put out their first picture of the vehicle they're not going to build in 2016. And then every couple of years thereafter, they created a new engineering model of put a graph. And I don't know if any engineers were involved or just the graphics department, but they built really cute, shiny graphical images of four different vehicles that they have never built any of. And they claim that 3 years from now, one of those vehicles will be built and they'll be in competition. They've made the same mistake. They're building a vehicle four times larger than our vehicle. They say that it's going to stay up in the air for five continuous years. I'm not sure if they understand what happens to motors at 20,000 meters and minus 60 C, but I don't think there's any motor in the world that can stay up in that atmosphere and keep running continuously for 5 years. But they say they're going to build this vehicle. But they're a big contractor, and they've already gotten the French government to give them $2 million just to produce these graphical images. So I wish I could get some government to give me $20 million to put a nice picture, because then I'd be done with my fundraising, because I don't need more than that to build this vehicle. That's really the only competition we have. There are a bunch of people building aircraft bypass. It's a high-altitude vehicle that the aircraft will operate at 20,000 meters or around there and have various missions. Most of those vehicles have a problem staying up for long periods of time. They might have two of the companies have a hydrogen fuel source, which may last 5 to 7 days. One company does say they're going to operate with batteries and solar panels like we do. But these vehicles are very lightweight, and they have very limited power and very limited payload weight. Like the one vehicle that's being used by the UK military, built by Airbus, called Zephyr, and it's got about a 12-kilogram, about 28-pound payload, and has very limited power. But it's fine for the UK military to put some kind of observation payload on, and they can move the vehicle around. The other thing about aircraft vehicles, they're not great for telecom because they're moving too fast to be able to keep their spot beam in the right position and efficiently use frequencies. But there are a lot of aircraft taps that could be used for strategic purposes, to do military stuff, to do carbon capture analysis in the atmosphere, Earth observation, other things. We're just not competing with that. We're focused on telecom.
Tom, did we lose you, or is that something else?
No, I'm right here.
Okay, well, I'm hearing something else beeping on the phone. Listeners, again, our number, if you would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223, and email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. For either one of you, Betty in Boston said, I remember it was only a year or two ago where there was a crucial helium shortage, at least in the United States. Has that been fixed? Is there still a helium shortage? Does this affect you?
Well, there is a helium shortage in some ways. It's more of a market failure than a real shortage. Most natural gas wells, when the gas comes out of the ground, between, I think, about 3 to 7% of that gas is helium. And so the natural gas well operators have to remove the helium before they sell the natural gas. But they do that at locations all over, and they don't capture that helium and then resell it. So they do some kind of process, which I think is lowering the temperature of the natural gas, and then the helium and the natural gas have different specific weights. And so then they can bleed off the natural gas, I mean the helium, and just let it go. Well, that's fine. Helium's natural, goes up in the atmosphere, doesn't hurt anybody. But so it's possible that if we are finding the cost of helium is excessive, that we could begin working with the natural gas producers near where we need the helium and possibly make some kind of deal where we help them with their refining process of removing the helium and get the helium at a much lower cost, or at least get it at a reasonable cost. So there's just massive amounts of helium being released from the natural gas processing organizations in thousands of locations across the United States and all over the world. But that isn't, right now we're able to make a nice profit by buying helium on the current market, at the current market price, which is ridiculously high because of who knows why the providers haven't, maybe they're happy with these high prices because they're getting a better margin. I don't know.
Tom, I've got a question specifically from you, from Robert. And Robert says Los Angeles, but it's a big area, so I have no clue which Robert it is or where in Los Angeles. But he
I have
said,
a good guess, but go ahead.
But he says, Tom, I hear you talk quite a bit about space, scalable businesses, and opportunities. This is not really in space, but do you consider this a space scalable business, and why?
No, I do not. And the reason being, a space scalable business by definition, because I was the one who originally defined it, is a business, a technology that's primarily designed to serve customers and make investors wealthy right here in the terrestrial markets, but it's just, the technology can specifically be scaled to also serve a space purpose down the road when the market is available for that. And so, the example I always use is a couple of guys I know who developed a very unique type of electric motor that only had one moving part, and they wanted to, you know, take over electric cars and stuff with this motor. And I looked at that thing and said, well, I could see that on a Mars rover as well someday. So something like that would qualify. This is, you know, I like to tell people when I go and pitch Avialto, I'll tell them, look, I'm in the satellite communications business. But my satellite doesn't orbit the Earth. And while it is not geosynchronous, therefore, it is, however, geostationary. And welcome to the world of high-altitude platforms. And then I, you know, go into my spiel. But the space scalable, no, it's not. We use space components. In fact, the transponders we use are virtually identical to the transponders that do go into a lot of big, heavy satellites. They're just not space-hardened, which means they're a lot lighter, and we can carry more of them and deliver more bandwidth.
Well, the story has always been many times. I'm a big promoter of space, too, and been involved in space industry many years, is that space technologies benefit Earth. And this is a classic situation. We're using virtually identical radio systems, transmission parameters, codecs, modems, ground stations as the satellite industry. So all the brilliant innovations that have been made to make satellite communication more efficient, even though it's a high-priced cost for the satellites themselves, we can now use those innovations and cost-saving things with a HAP to really provide a very efficient telecom services in some regions. So the other interesting thing is we're a U.K. company, so ESA is a member of European Space Agency, UK is still a member, even though after Brexit. And so we talk a lot with the people here, and they're big supporters of HAPS. And we ask them, why are you involved in HAPS when you're European Space Agency? And they said, close enough. You're on the edge of space. So we, for some reason, ESA has taken HAPS as part of their regulatory purview and considered, and they've had two major conferences on HAPS over the last 4 years, to promote it. So who knows?
Can you do any, I would say on orbit, but I guess on station repairs and servicing, or does it always have to come back down to Earth?
It might be possible. I've always been fascinated on over servicing and have been worked on that a long time ago, and now there are companies really doing it, which is exciting. It really is easier to bring the HAP back down than to send something up to try to service it. What is more likely to go wrong with that, what goes wrong with satellites is they run out of fuel, and so you want to send something up to keep it in, to grab it and hold it in position. You really can't fix a transponder on a satellite with on-orbit servicing. Sometimes the other thing that might go wrong is the batteries might fail, and so there are ways that newer satellites have ways to plug into those batteries. It's going to be easier to bring the HAP down and bring the other HAP up so we can really dig into what's wrong, because what's probably wrong is something inside our housing, like a card, a telecom card broke, or a wire got loose or something like that, something that couldn't be fixed remotely.
Can a HAP be strengthened? Maybe that's not the right word, but to have a larger radius than 120 kilometers or so, can it cover a bigger area?
Not really. I mean, from 20,000 meters, if you just do the math, I think you can see, the horizon, if you're at 20,000 meter, I think the horizon may be more than 580 kilometers away. I'm not remembering, but it's a lot more than the distance where the 120 radius of the circle we cover. The problem is satellite technology, you're then transmitting at an angle where effectively something on the ground, your ground station, if there's a building, a hill, or a dog in the road, it's going to block the signal. Because the level, your antenna is going to be pointing almost parallel to the ground if you try to send a HAP signal more than 120 kilometers from the center of where the HAP is to the distant area we're covering, a 240-kilometer circle. And so that 10-degree angle is the maximum that most satellites operate at. So it's just not practical. Now, over the ocean, or possibly over areas, you mentioned Montana or Arizona, it is possible that in those very flat areas that we could extend the coverage out another 40 miles or so, you know, 150-mile circle. We might have to add another 20, 30 miles out further in some instances where we'd rather do that than put another HAP in the air. But those guys' antennas will almost be pointing straight ahead, parallel to the ground to get signals. And the signal strength will not be as good. Of course, in those desert areas, there isn't as much rain. So, but generally, it's optimized to have this look angle of 10 degrees, and to have about 240 kilometer circle, 150 mile kilometer circle.
Kelly is in Phoenix, Arizona, and Kelly says, I can see some possibilities, but maybe technically my idea is not feasible, where you could use your HAP to give a boost for an air launch type of vehicle. Is that a possibility?
One of our early vendors did some work that way, where they placed effectively a lighter-than-air vehicle at a certain height and launched rockets from that vehicle. And the theory is that the first 20,000 kilometers, the first 65,000 feet, you experience more air resistance, obviously at ground level, than you do at 10,000 feet. And every time you go up, the air is thinner, so there's less resistance. So if you start a rocket launch at this higher height, that you will have a more efficient utilization of fuel. And what is it? Paul Allen was building a large airplane for that purpose, to take that airplane up to, I don't know, 50,000 feet and launch rockets from that height, again, to save that air resistance. When you really do the math, it doesn't help you that much. All the effort to bring the rocket up to that height gets you a little bit of benefit, but the cost and effort to take it to that height isn't that valuable. right now, you're still using a rocket. You're still having multiple stages. So in the States, I'm a space guy, and I've studied this, and I just have never found it to be that valuable to do that. We know how to build the stages in to allow the rocket to get from ground to that height where it drops a stage and goes higher. My goal for efficiency is someday to have enough space commerce activity to justify the space elevator that Arthur Clarke talked about in the past, to really pull things up from the equator. But you need enough activity. You don't build an elevator into an empty building. So we need enough space activity to justify the billions and billions that such a device will cost. And I think that's the place where we replace rockets completely to launch from Earth.
Interesting. Any chance that it can give people a ride up somehow and maybe come back in something more like a hot air balloon gondola, something maybe that's competitive to the new service that's going to start in Florida?
There are other people doing that, and that's their specialty. There's a guy in Barcelona, a guy I know, and I wish I remembered his name right now, and he was an ISU graduate, so I met him, and he's building balloons specifically to go up to the stratosphere where people could take an amazing ride to the edge of space and not be there for 3 minutes, like the Virgin Galactic approach of go up like a roller coaster and come back down. They'll be able to stay up there for hours, have lunch, have a bottle of wine, and come back down from the edge of space. And he's building the necessary technology. With humans, you need to make sure they stay alive. So you need a very well-pressurized container with a huge amount of safety protocols and backup systems to make sure that you don't harm your passengers. For us, we have a much lower risk ratio. If our compartment that holds the battery gets depressurized, we may lose a vehicle, but we won't lose any human. So,
Jerry says he's in New York City, and he says, do you see a point in the near future where you might have some type of public offering, SPAC, EFT presence, something of that nature, where others can get in on the act rather than doing venture capital-like investments?
Well, right now we are raising funds, and any qualified investor could talk to us. So anyone who's qualified in the U.S. and in other countries, there are other rules. So we are, but right now I've been involved in a number of IPOs with companies I've run. Before we do that, we want to generate revenue. So we have a huge revenue opportunity worldwide, and if we put up hundreds of HAPs, the revenue levels will get into the billions of dollars. That may be the right time to go to the public markets. And so the real opportunity is for somebody that wants to see a massive increase would be somebody who is a qualified investor or a VC fund that can see why this might be a good idea to get in now, because the value increase will be much greater between today, where we don't have a flying vehicle and we're talking about it, but we don't have the proof of building that final vehicle, even though we're close. When we fly that, there'll be a huge value increase. When we put the first 10 or 12 in the air and really make it a viable business, there'll be another huge step increase. After that, probably not. So, but certainly if anybody on here is a qualified investor and can see this possibility, we'll be happy to share a lot more data with them and show them why. I've done telecom businesses, 4 different telecom companies. 2 went public, 2 were sold to public companies. I believe this is better than all the stuff I've done combined. I believe as a business case, it's better, more valuable company than everything I've ever done times 10. That's my opinion, not official investment advice. But I'm excited about this not only because of the business opportunity, but because telecom is such a basic need. It used to be, they said, development required roads, electricity, and airports, okay?
Hello? Walt? Tom, are you there?
Oh, I'm here, yeah.
Did I lose Tom? Did I lose Walt?
I think that's a very good possibility. I think I know where he was going, though.
Well,
maybe I can pitch in.
Yeah, go ahead, and I'll see if I can call him back, okay? While you're talking, okay?
Sure.
Okay, go.
But, okay. You need infrastructure all over the world, yes. And we're at a place where we're still looking at a world where 3.2 or so billion people just don't have access to the kind of infrastructure that the rest of us are starting to learn to take for granted. Now, this whole business excites me on multiple levels. I love the technology. I love the portability of it. I love the quick change artistry that you can do, because every 3 to 6 months we can drop the thing out of the air and put up another one, do a handoff, do some modifications and some upgrades, and you're off and running again. Try doing that with a satellite. But at the same time, I also like the opportunity to actually expand the reach to all humanity. The other thing, that part that excites me as well, is we have, you know, over 3 billion people that, you know, what's going to happen when they join the conversation? That's going to be absolutely amazing, and I cannot personally wait to hear what those folks have to say.
Still trying to reach him, Tom, so.
Okay, that's I'm sorry that happened. It's very abrupt. Cut off, boom, done. You know, and that's happened to me before. more than once, and I've had to, and I find myself talking to dead air for, you know, 5 minutes before I realized I wasn't talking to anybody. So, Walt may still be talking.
No, I've got Walt back on the phone.
I figured it out after about 5 minutes. All right. I don't know where you lost me, so I'm going to repeat the answer to that question, but I'll make it shorter than my original one. We are in the process of raising funds from qualified investors or individuals that have, you know, make this type of investment. There's regulations in the U.S. about that, but many people are qualified. We think we'll go public when the company becomes larger and when that's appropriate to raise more capital. I've been involved in 4 different companies, telecom companies, and 2 went public, 2 were sold to public companies. We generated a lot of return for our investors, but I think this business will be worth 10 times or more of all the things I've done in my whole lifetime. And I think it's just a huge opportunity, not only as a profitable business, but the benefits to each community that we serve, remote communities without telecom. It's a basic building block of development, maybe one of the most important ones. And that's why I'm so excited about this. It's more than just a business, but it will be a great business. And so anybody that does want to join us now or in the future, we'd love to talk to you.
Is there information on your Avioto website about this, or if somebody's interested, do they get it?
Well, there's an inquiry email on the website. We're not promoting investors on the website because that creates some legal and technical difficulties. You're not really supposed to do that, and
correct,
we don't do it. But someone who's interested who sent a message to our inquiry email, we would make sure they were a qualified or appropriate investor, and we'd be happy to talk to them. No problem.
Okay, so listeners, if you go to their website, which is avialto.com, over on the far right, there is a contact button, and that's where you'll find the U.S. as well as the U.K. phone number and the email address if you have further questions. And investment questions are really more probably appropriate to talk to Walt than posting them on the blog. But if I do see any posts on the blog that are looking for investment information, I'll forward them to you, Walt.
Yeah. This is a critical time in terms of valuation because we are pre-revenue. We have no revenue yet. And once we put our first vehicle in the air, we'll begin taking customer advance payments, and that will probably have an effect. We believe, in my opinion, that it'll have an effect on the share price. It's fairly substantial because we think we'll be the first operator to do this kind of business, the first company to build a viable high-altitude platform for telecom.
We're actually coming up on our on my hard stop at 90 minutes, but what have we not talked about that we should talk about or that
I haven't asked you questions about, or I've been too ignorant to ask you questions about. What else? This is the opportunity for either or both of you to tell us what's been missing.
Well, I'd like Tom to take a first shot at that. I've talked a lot. So.
Well, okay. I mean, just very briefly, because I wanted to talk about a little bit about the business and capital model. Because they're based on very specific parameters. Walt kind of alluded to it, that if we have 200 of these platforms in the sky, we could have billions in revenue. But what is that really based on? And it's based on all the analysis we've done just developing one vehicle. We figure off that single vehicle, if we could run it at 90% capacity, which is the goal everywhere we go, you can make your revenue on even 60% capacity, but I think we've got some great low-hanging fruit around the world that we can get 90% capacity, without a lot of trouble. At that capacity, the revenue stream from that for us comes out to about, and this is after expenses, but before EBITDA, about $11 million per year, per half that's in the air. And if you assume a 5-year lifetime for each individual vehicle, you're going to be generating about $55 million in pre-tax revenue off of that single half over that 5-year period. So now expand that to 100 or 200 of them. And this is where the numbers come from that make us, that make us also a potential acquisition target down the road.
That's a pretty big number.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you look at the orbital geosynchronous satellite industry as a whole, the Satellite Industry Association, I don't remember, 2020 or 2020, the last figures, was around $121 billion in total. And that's the high-priced geosynchronous satellite services. Now, 80% of that is one-to-many, point-to-multi-point, which is primarily TV, the dish TV we talked about earlier. But 20% of it, around $26 billion, is the markets that we can serve. They're existing markets that we can serve, where we can be lower cost. And again, we don't think we'll cover all of that market because we're not going to put a half on every part of the earth. But we think this 80-20 rule applies, that there's a potential market of 80% of that, maybe 20 billion of that 26 billion, we potentially could have because we'll have a half covering those territories. Now that's the existing market. The 3 to 4 billion people in the world that don't have service, these are not all poor people. They may not be very wealthy people. A lot of them are just people that live in the wrong place. They have businesses, farms, operations. They sell and buy stuff. They have local cell phone service, but they can't call internationally because of limitations. So if we were able to serve even 1 out of 10 of those 3 to 4 billion people, that's another $90 billion potential market for us. And that's a market that only we can touch, or I should say only a half can touch. We'll probably have competitors following us in a few years. But if we're the first mover, we can grab the best areas, the low-hanging fruit. That's a huge, huge market, and I'd be happy to get even a portion of that.
It sounds fascinating, doesn't it? I mean, it is exciting. Has anybody ever come along and critically punched holes in your technology?
Not yet. Actually, that's interesting. One of our that's good to have somebody looking at your technology critically, especially with the prior failures in this industry, the crazy things that people did and the bad judgment exercised by some companies in not acknowledging the failure of their technology. One of our venture capital investors is actually funding another company, a company that has expertise, to review our entire technology, and it's coming at exactly the right time before we put more effort into building a large vehicle. So we're going to have, within a couple of months, we're going to have a report from these guys that will tell us any areas where they see weaknesses or improvements or other things, and we welcome that. That's valuable for us because we don't want to, I'm not, I don't, I'm, it's my own effort here. I want to make this work. And so by having outsiders look at this and find, like Facebook poke holes in some of our assumptions, we may improve it, and do better.
Fascinating that, that someone is doing that to see what your challenges and weak points are, if any.
Yeah, we were excited when they, that this venture capital group that's already made a small investment was willing to fund this, program to check us out. And, it's really going to help us, I think. I'm sure that they'll find some areas where we can use take the advice from their report and benefit from it.
So, and you think operations are going to begin in, around this time, give or take, in 2022?
We hope so. There are many things that could prevent that, but we're trying to plan ahead so that we don't run into any of those things.
Well, we absolutely will stay in touch and obviously follow it, and I hope so, too. I guess I should ask, although I know you don't raise money on the phone, but for qualified investors, is there a minimum dollar investment amount?
$50,000.
Okay. And your exit plan, since we're talking about these kinds of things, is there an exit plan?
Well, that's what every investor says, is there an exit plan? Well, every company I've started, we obviously wanted ultimately to cash out, to somehow benefit. And there are really different three ways to do that. You can talk about all the fancy stuff. You can either go public, you can sell to a public company, or your company could be so profitable, it's generating enough revenue that you never want to do that. You just want to take the dividends from the stock and keep using them. The margins we have are so good, it is possible that after we talk to our investors, that we may decide not to go public or sell to a public company, but to just take the margins from the shares and live off those. And if any of our investors desperately needed to cash out, it's likely the company could buy them out and still and not have to sell the whole company. It's possible. These are, I'm saying highly speculative things that that can't be taken as certain by any potential investor. But I would love to be in a position to run this company longer term and to not have to sell it to get, you know, profits out of it. And I think that might be possible.
Since you're the big shot behind it, let me take another minute or two, because I know my unfortunate hard-ass break is coming up. You as the CEO, and you're the only one listed on the website as the team, your age, your health, are you in good shape? Are you turning into an old codger? What's your status?
Well, I can still run, not as fast as I used to be able to do. And I come from a very long-lived family, so I have hopes. Basically, I plan to live long enough so I can understand quantum physics.
It's going to be quite a while.
It could be quite a while. as far as the company goes, though, the management team, our early management team, is composed of older, you know, not 20-year-olds, but we have some people younger than me, and we are going to be building a lot. We're going to be adding a lot of employees, and I believe that this company could go on without me if it had to. I wouldn't like that, but I think it could.
Are you, do you want to say how old you are?
No.
Listen, I know Walt, and I can tell you he's younger than I am, and I frequently state my age, which is 75, but I know you're
I'm a lot younger than you
I know you're a lot
younger. Well, okay.
And Tom is also a lot younger than me.
So. And Walt's only a little bit older than me.
You're still going strong, David. I think that's great.
Well, the space, yeah. You know, you got to use your damn mind. And the space show and the topics and the guests ranging from physics and quantum physics and, you know, all sorts of stuff to business advanced stuff. It's not all
you know, flaky kind of wah, wah, rah, I'm a new space businessman overnight. It keeps you sharp and keeps you on your toes. Tom knows what I'm talking about with that last
I mean, I'm really, I'm really motivated on this. I mean, I've been financially successful. I want to make this business financially successful because that's the only way it'll grow. But it's more than that. I have made in my life a teeny difference in the world, I think, I hope. I think this company, I could make a much bigger difference, and that would be very cool in a positive way to do that.
Gentlemen, that's going to be it for today. I will look forward to staying in touch with both of you and seeing how it works out in the next year. I hope you make those goals. I will get the program archived and send you both the links to it, which will probably be tomorrow since I'm going to be at a dentist appointment the rest of the day. But I'm really pleased you're making great progress, and it really sounds exciting, and I wish I were in a position to join in. Listeners, I know his business record, and, you know, I always tell you that better than all of what you're going to read in the damn prospectus, you got to bet on people, and people make things happen, and some people have great ideas and can't make the damn thing happen. And some people ruin great ideas, and other people can take just a mediocre idea and make a damn fortune, like a pet rock. And you gotta, whatever you're doing, whether you're buying monies for your retirement funds with IRAs or whatever, you gotta look at the management and who's running the business, and you gotta bet on people. And people are, to me, far more key than all the fundamentals, all the disclosures, all the performance, all the marketing plans, all of that stuff. Because you don't have people with you that can make things happen. You could have gold-plated everything on a silver platter and not get to base one. So I know Walt. I know his history, and I know his businesses. And, you know, I've sat with him at Space Frontier conferences talking about businesses and things that he was doing at the time. He knows how to make things happen. And does Tom.
David, thank you so much for hosting us, even though we're not quite space. I will tell you that on my team, the six key managers, which include Tom, myself, and there are two other people who are space enthusiasts. Four out of six are very heavy space. And so we all have said that if this is profitable, we're going to spend the money on continuing to develop space.
Well, I'm fine if you take the money and run. It's your money, and you've earned it. And I believe that people have a right to do what they
want
with their money.
But I want to do space. It's exciting.
You know, so you know, Bezos and
we're going to build a commercial space station, and we're either going to call it Mir 2 or Walt's Revenge. I don't know which, but
just be careful on what you do up there, because things have a way of getting out, and do good things with it. Guys, I got to run. Thank you both for being here. Listeners, thank you for your emails, and I will get it archived and up to you as quickly as possible. And it's the weekend, everybody, so enjoy it. Have fun. Stay healthy. Stay safe. As always, keep looking up. And remember our great sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. We would not be doing this program without their sponsorship. And we're always open to new sponsors. And you know how to reach me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Goodbye from Walt, Tom, and David. And again, keep looking up.